Now, you've already been introduced to Dr. Duncan, and we've heard from him, and to Dr. Lilback. This is our pastor, Pastor Harry Reeder. He's a senior pastor here at Briarwood Presbyterian Church, best boss I have. This is Dr. Paul Cleveland. He's an author and a professor of economics at Birmingham Southern College. And this is Congressman Gary Palmer from the 6th District of Alabama. So before they frustrate you with their answers, why don't you welcome them? Okay, all of these questions are about Donald Trump, okay? Every one of these, okay? So, guys, let me get this one dealt with out of the way. And they come at a lot of different angles, okay? So I'm going to throw out a couple of these different angles and then get some of you to respond. And, Peter, I'm going to ask you to respond first, okay? It's because I like you so much, all right? Okay, the questions have to do with... we're always told to vote our conscience, but now we're told to do something else by other people. Is Donald Trump God's judgment on America? If both candidates don't have Christian values, should we abstain from voting? Should we vote for a person for president of this country whose godliness is in question, i.e. Donald Trump? Evangelical church, there's acknowledgement that Mr. Trump is a believer. Is that accurate in your opinion? And if so, how do we know that? It does not show up to me. There are numerous questions as it relates to, does character count anymore? We've been told that character is a driving force of elections, and our pastors have told us that. And now, are we to set aside character? How would you speak to the choosing of the lesser of two evils? So, Peter, I'll let you start. And then anybody else can chime in as they want.
How many of those can I plead the Fifth Amendment to? Well, let me answer this by giving my own personal story. When the election season was beginning many, many months ago, and there were a whole host of candidates on the Republican side, and people know I voted and argued for conservative candidates for many years, they said, "Who are you going to support?" And I said, "I have no idea who I'm going to support, but I'm pretty convinced I'm going to support the last man standing." And the reason for that was very clear. Westminster Seminary was hit straight over the head with the Affordable Care Act's mandate that requires institutions that hire people to provide abortion service to their employees, regardless of the institution's conscience. There's no exception for us because we're not a church, even though we are a Christian organization. And yes, our case has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. It's one of the decisions that the Supreme Court said we don't know how to reach an answer. They send it back to the contestants. And we're actually working out between the contestants a possible solution. That's never happened in this form before in the history of the court, my understanding is. We're grateful that we're one of the few seminaries that had the courage to take that position. Now, why is that important for this question? Well, it's because when I learned that on the Democratic side, there was a commitment to continue the current administration's policies, I said, how can I support anyone on that side if they are going to continue to pursue a policy that's seeking to destroy the institution that I lead? I said, I have no choice. If I'm going to vote, I have to vote for someone that has at least the possibility of protecting the rights of conscience of a pro-life reformed seminary, which Westminster Seminary has since its birth in 1929. And so that means I'm supporting Donald Trump. Is that because he was my first choice? I don't think so. Does character matter? Yes. And while this is not a happy solution, and this does maybe address the idea of the lesser of two evils, I was listening to Bill Bennett some months ago, just when it looked like maybe Donald Trump might begin to be the competitor in the process. It was unclear. He said, well, here's what we know as we look at the Supreme Court. We know that the Supreme Court is going to be filled by the next president. And if it is Hillary Clinton, or at this time Bernie Sanders was at least a slight possibility, I said, we can be absolutely sure that 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 justices are going to be appointed that are going to stand against historic values that have than close to conservatism, to Christian values. And he said, so we're basically what we're doing in this election, we're playing Russian roulette. If you take the revolver with Hillary Clinton, you spin it all you want, there's six bullets in the chamber and you're dead. Said, with Donald Trump, we don't know. Said, maybe there's three bullets in the chamber. You got a 50-50 chance. Well, since that time, he's come out with his Federalist Society approved list of Supreme Court nominees. Now, obviously, the question of character comes to bear. Is he committed to that? He said so. Will he appoint someone that will be more to the values that we believe are important? So at the end of the day, I conclude a long answer. You gave me six questions, so I'm trying to answer them all in one, Bruce. Okay. I believe that this is a matter of conscience. I respect anyone who says, I don't know how to vote, or I'm not voting for either. But I would say don't do that as a cheap jumping out of your responsibility. Wrestle with the issues. You are called to render unto Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God's. And you're called to wrestle through this. For me, I've made the decision that America can withstand, I believe, 4 to 8 years of either one of these people as president. Neither one are my ideals, I'll be honest. But my deep concern is, can America survive a Supreme Court that's packed with a liberal ideology that will carry on for 30 to 40 years potentially? And that is a staggering concern. And so I conclude with this. My daughter, I won't mention where or which one, asked me, Dad, who are you going to vote for? And I said, I want you to know, I don't know that I can vote for somebody who's been proven to be a liar under oath by the most important law enforcement organization in America. I have a problem with that. So I wish I had a better choice. But for me, the issue at the end of the day is who is going to lead us in the Supreme Court. And that is the great issue of concern. We have three bullets and three empty chambers. Or we have a gun where every bullet is in every chamber. So that's why my choice is, it's my last man standing. It's what I committed myself to, because I think it's the only hope that we have of having a high court that is not going to crush the conscience of pro-life organizations like Westminster Seminary. So that's my view.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on it. And I think that the two people remaining are a reflection of who we've become as a country. It's a reflection of us. And I think the question is less about them than it is about who we've become and how we fail to engage strategically and intelligently as Christians. We've abandoned politics when politics is one of the ripest mission fields in the world. We desperately need leadership there, but we have what we're left with. In regard to Trump, I'll tell you this. I visited New York City and saw Trump Towers, as I looked at that magnificent building, I did not stand there and look at it and think that Donald Trump is an inspired architect. I didn't think he's a brilliant engineer. I didn't think he's a great construction manager. I thought he hired an inspired architect. He hired a brilliant engineer. He had brilliant construction managers. And if you look at who he's brought around him in his campaign, these are good people. And that list, by the way, was not approved by the Federalist Society. It was provided by the Federalist Society for potential Supreme Court nominees. And I would take any one of them. The other thing is Kellyanne Conway, who is now his campaign manager. I've known her for 25 years. She is rock solid. She actually called me right as this began. And I went outside and talked to her for a while, and I told her that we would pray for her. So we need to be praying about this. And the last thing that I'd say about this is this issue of voting your conscience. Vote the issues. I think you can vote the issues and vote your conscience. And the choice couldn't be clearer. If you simply took the names off the ballot and looked at where we are in unemployment, where we are in foreign policy, and where we are in national security, and where we are in terms of Obamacare and the social issues, You know, millions of Christians refused to vote for Mitt Romney, and he lost the election because of it. And some of you may have chosen to sit that out, but I can assure you that if Mitt Romney were president today, we would not be talking about transgendered bathrooms today.
Something. I'm not a politician or a pollster, and I don't even play one on TV. I am a political junkie, and I watch politics closely, and I won't give you my connections, but I do think when you go in the polling booth in November, it is of prime importance to think about the House and the Senate. The Republicans are on track to lose 18 House seats, 4 Senate seats, and the presidency by 5 to 10 points. And I will go into the voting booth thinking about the Supreme Court, but I'll be thinking about the House and the Senate more than I think about anything. Because I fully expect a 2-term Hillary Clinton presidency. Maybe by a landslide.
I'm not sure. I think we'll know more about that after the first or second debate. Polls are a snapshot in time, and there are a couple of polls out there that show things closer than they are, and I recognize those as outliers. But I think that we've got to give Kellyanne Conway a chance to bring something to the Trump campaign that has been missing, and that is message discipline. If the guy stays on the points, if he stays on the issues, I think he's got a chance, because if the election is about Hillary, she will lose. If the election is about Trump, he will lose. But if the election's about the issues, he will win.
Okay, pastorally speaking, have we not fallen into the trap of asking the government to do what the church is truly responsible for? We're to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but it's the church, the body of believers, who should be living righteously independent of the whims of secular society.
I want to jump in on that because it reflects something that was said by William Temple, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury during World War II, and I love quoting liberals to liberals. And I've used this several times, and it really applies to this lottery debate that's going on here in the state and the expansion of Medicaid. The church has a fundamental role in caring for people. And William Temple said this. He said, the difference between the government and the church is that the government can only deal with people the way they are. They get pregnant out of wedlock, they can give them welfare, they can give them food stamps and Medicaid, a housing allowance. But it can only deal with them the way they are. But the church can deal with people the way they are and the way they ought to be. And we really need to reengage the church in addressing these issues if we hope to bring the culture back to where it ought to be.
I would say, too, that along with that, that you know, people tend to worship that upon which they're dependent. And a colleague of mine who teaches economics at Boise State wrote a book, and she titled it Dependent on D.C. And really the whole strategy, the Marxist strategy and the progressive strategy in America has been one of turning everything on its head and moving towards dependency upon our government. And it's been a slow slog. And I happened to be listening. This was when Bill Clinton was running for president in the first term. And I was listening to talk radio in the car one day, and a man called in to the host, and he said, I cannot wait until Bill Clinton's elected president and we get nationalized health care, and then I won't have to pray to God that my children don't get sick. And right away, it was clear he was going to blaspheme God. And he was going to turn his dependency, he was going to turn away from God and turn to government as his savior. And that's really fundamentally our problem. It's an economic problem, it's a political problem, and it's a religious problem.
We've heard Pastor Reeder and others mentioned this in the context of giving, for God loves a cheerful giver. And that's in the context of a famine that has taken place in Judea. And Paul the Corinthians had said they were going to take up an offering, and Paul had written back and said, I'm coming back to get the gift and take it back, so make sure it's ready when I get here. And if you go on and read the rest of that, he tells you that not only was the gift to meet the needs, but it had another fundamental purpose. It was that it might result in an outpouring of praise and thanksgiving to God. And your point there about worshiping another God, the God that sends the check every month, is a key point, because when we substitute the government for the church, the focus changes. We need to engage not only to meet the need, but so that it might result in an outpouring of praise and thanksgiving to God. And we've missed that, I think.
Well, I think I've actually had a little evolution of thought on this. What kind of is presented is, well, the reason we've got this burgeoning government is because the church isn't doing its job in these areas. And I have come to reject that. I don't believe the government is stepping in because the church is not doing its job. I believe the government has been strategically prohibiting the church from doing its job and telling the church and others that we can do it better, and then creating the crisis that says, you can't handle it, we can. You can't educate your children, we can. You can't take care of, but if you'll go take a look right now, for instance, I believe part of what Dr. Lilbeck was talking about in terms of the Obamacare provisions, everybody says, well, don't do that. You'll drive the churches and Christians out of the hospital and medical field. Well, I actually think that's what they're trying to do. Then they can put their people in there. So now, do I think we've done everything the way we should in all of these matters of mercy ministry? No, I don't. But I do believe, I mean, folks, I've seen you, even under the obligations and burdens of regulations and things that have been put upon you, I've seen you as a people that I go home and weep with thanksgiving to serve the Lord with you because of your generous spirit in so many areas. I've seen hundreds of you into the urban city schools and doing tutoring. I also know of those teachers that you're working with and what they labor under in fear that they're going to do something wrong and therefore your tutoring will get them in trouble. Yet they'll step up and say, I'm going to do it anyway. So what I'm trying to tell you is, I don't believe it's that we've been so bad at what we should be doing that the government's had to step in. I think the government has very strategically created the crisis and the regulations to keep believers individually, organizationally, and churches out of it, and then saying, but we have the solution for you. And once they become the go-to, then they then go to you to take away your resources and your liberties in order to do it, and thus the supremacy of the state. So that instead of a state that's under God, you now have a state that says it is God.
This is a scientific...
No, but just one. Okay. Do I think everybody in the government is doing that? Absolutely not. But there are people who are thinkers and have ideas, and we play. What? Here's what most of us right now. That's why we're in this election year. See, we think we've got to hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth inning, and whether Kelly can lead it or this person. That's what we always look at. The people that Dr. Lilbet was speaking of, they don't play last inning, let me hit a home run. In fact, even if they lose the game, they just reschedule another game. They're playing chess. We're trying to come up with one big home run to what we think is going to win it.
And they've been at it for a very long time.
That's
well
right.
Over 100 years.
And so I'm sorry, Dr. No, I interrupted great. You.
I was just going to add, in Philadelphia, back in the Bush administration, there is a professor by the name of Ram Kanan, who did a massive empirical investigation in the faith-based initiative sphere. And his report came back and said, with all the house churches and storefront churches in Philadelphia. Every year, those little churches give the equivalent of $500 million of free services to the city. And his argument was, do you realize how important encouraging the faith-based community is? The government could not replace that if they took that over. It's impossible. So that's a scientific study that was just done of what we could say is a pretty broken, hurting city. And yet it's $500 million of free services to the community by faith-based. And that's a scientific study by the University of Pennsylvania.
Stay with you, Dr. Lilback. What should pastors be doing to inform and equip their members to again influence our political system?
Okay. I think one of the things that we need to do, and this is where I would ask you all to pray for Westminster, and I know pray for RTS as well, because they're sharing this concern, is that we need to properly define the legitimacy and relevancy of what we call public theology. There is a real fear by many pastors and congregants that if we engage too much in the public issues of the day, that we're going to lose our witness, we're going to compromise our tax exemption, we're going to derail our mission. And so I think one of the things we really need to do is to revitalize what was a very important principle in the founding of America. It's actually called the Black-Robed Regiment. The clergy were an important arm of speaking about the public concerns of the day from God's word. I think Dr. Reeder is a great role model for all of us. He has the courage and ability to do that. We need to learn how to do that effectively so that younger pastors and churches and sessions and other places are encouraging their men to do it. So, one, we need better education. That's part of why we're doing this program. I think the second thing that we need to do is provide more open role models. So that's why I'm really glad that, again, to appeal to Dr. Reeder's presence. I'm glad you're sharing him broadly with the broader church, because we need more pastors who are in the pulpits showing younger men how to do this. I think another thing is that we need better education for our sessions, that there's a lot of fear out there that, well, we can't do this, we can do this. We need more information for our pastors and their elders about what the church can legitimately be doing. So on the educational side, I think there's a tremendous need to reengage. On the spiritual side, I would ask us to reconsider the fact, even as I tried to in my message tonight, say that the kingdom of God is holistic. It touches all of life, and we should not be afraid to recover that Kuiperian vision that every square inch belongs to King Jesus. So we need to see that everything is legitimate for the kingdom of God. So it's theological and it's role modeling and it's curricular. We need a lot of things we need to do.
From your exposure, broad exposure to our denomination, how would you assess how the PCA churches are doing in the area of public theology?
I would agree with Dr. Lilback. I think a lot of our pastors especially run from it in fear. Part of that is deliberate, and it flows from theological convictions that are often in reaction to the kind of cultural engagement that was prevalent, for instance, in the 1980s during the heyday of the moral majority. An approach to cultural engagement that attempts to do it from a majority standpoint and to take a kind of a high ground approach that rallies rather than persuades. And then I think it also comes from some quadrants that just don't think that Christians should be involved in this at all. A kind of gospel-centeredness that views Christianity as something that is private rather than public. By the way, I think one of the answers to the question you asked Dr. Lilback is people need to understand that Christianity cannot be lived privately. It's impossible to live Christianity privately. That's part of the point that Jesus is making in Matthew chapter 5. And I also think that we need to recognize that if we are honest about what we believe as Christians, there's no way to say it that ultimately can protect us from cultural marginalization. We have to be ready to be faithful, even where we say what we say is going to be very, very unpopular. But, I do think that there is a rich tradition of Reformed public theology that we need to relearn. And we meet it not only in the people that Pete was just referring to, the founding generation of America. The British Parliament referred to the American Revolution as the Presbyterian Revolution. There was a statement on the floor of the House of Commons that our cousin America has run off with a Presbyterian parson. So the Presbyterians were highly blamed in England for what happened in the colonies. But long before that, if you look at the whole history of Reformed Christianity in Scotland from the time of the Reformation, ministers were ready to speak to public issues without apology, as if they were diverting attention from gospel purposes.
Okay, Dr. Cleveland, you're the reigning economist on our panel here. So is it possible to make a meaningful reduction in our nation's debt without causing economic decline in the marketplace because of the reduction in federal spending?
The short answer, and we're running out of time, the short answer is the debt is the economic problem. And we're in debt because of the spending. They're spending money like crazy. They're printing it up. They're wanting to tax you into poverty. That's the goal. Most everything that's coming out of Washington, D.C. in terms of economics is essentially a lie. They'll point to GDP going up. Well, GDP is just consumption plus investment plus government spending. Well, yeah, it's going to go up. But, you know, unemployment going down, well, labor force participation's gone down. So things are just statistical malfeasance coming out of Washington. And really what we need to have happen is we need a government downsizing. And then the economy will do quite well.
Since I'm on the budget committee, may I respond?
All the economic?
No, I have a very high regard for Dr. Cleveland. If you haven't read his book, Unmasking the Sacred Lie, which is the best book I've read on the progressive movement, you need to read it. But let me do what I do best, and that's get in the weeds, and I'll do it very quickly. If we stay on the same path we're on right now, and by 2040, our debt to GDP will be 146%. And when he talked about GDP as government spending, consumption, and business investment, we've gone up in government spending. There's no question about that. It's been an increase in consumer spending. But the third area has been a decline. Prior to 2008, there were 100,000 more businesses opening more than were closing. Since 2014, it's now 70,000 more closing than opening. That's the bad news. The good news is, and the Congressional Budget Office put out a report, and I'm a little over a third of the way through it, but we need to be at about 39% debt to GDP. And to do that, we've got to have a combination of revenue increases and spending cuts that add up to $560 billion. Well, here we are. We're deficit spending right at $500 billion. And we need to have a combination of revenue plus spending cuts that equal 560. Here's the interesting thing. The General Accountability Office, the GAO, reported that last year the IRS failed to collect $430 billion in taxes. And I wanted to find out why. They said, well, by the time you go through the litigation and whatever you have to do and you get a settlement, what you collect is less than what you get. There's 100,000 federal employees who don't pay their income taxes. There's some members of Congress who don't. And frankly, when I filled out my paperwork, I missed that block that says, do you want to pay your income taxes, yes or no? I didn't see that. But anyway, it screams, why don't we have a consumption tax, a fair tax, or a flat tax if we're not collecting it all? If we had that, we would collect every dime we're supposed to have. Your taxes would go down, revenues would go up. The GAO also reported that we sent out $130 billion in improper payments. $5 billion of it went to dead people. I said I'm going to introduce a bill that calls Zeroing Out Money and Benefits Improperly Expended, the Zombie Act. They really are the walking dead. But add those two together, that's $560 billion. Then the Office of Management Budget published a report and said we collected $516 billion in fees, a lot of which doesn't even show up in the Treasury. It just stays in the agency. And what I'm telling you is that there's not an easy solution, but there is a solution. And it's going to require sacrifices on all our part. And this is what I've tried to tell Paul Ryan, and I'll conclude with this. This is what's missing in leadership in the country right now. And I told Paul Ryan, we need to aspire to greatness. Because the things that we have to do is going to require a great Congress. I don't mean aspire to greatness as individuals. That's what the church needs to aspire to the glory of God. We need to aspire to greatness, and greatness comes at a cost. There's struggle, there's hardship, there's sacrifice, there's loss. Some of us will lose our seats if we do the right thing, but if we do, we'll walk out knowing that we did what we need to do to save the country. And that's what I've been trying to get across to leadership, is that we need to be the kind of Congress that when we leave office 10 years after we're gone, they can walk up to us and say, you were part of the greatest Congress this country's ever seen. That's the key. And I think the key is for the church to engage intelligently in an informed manner, not for power, not for influence, but to the glory of God. And that's how we bring the country back.
Thank you. I want to thank these gentlemen. Okay, as you can see, we didn't quite get all the questions answered, okay? But if you'll come back tomorrow night, I will give you a mechanism by which you can get your question answered. You'll have to think about that answer over the evening, okay? I'll give you a way to get your question answered. We start back tomorrow night at 6. Dr. Duncan, Pastor Reeder will be giving addresses. Tomorrow evening we'll have another question and answer time. Following that, make your way back to the book table, and we will see you tomorrow evening.